There is this deeply ingrained assumption we all carry around pretty much every single
Oh,
day.
yeah,
You
absolutely.
reach out, you knock your knuckles against a solid wooden desk, you feel that hard grain pushing back against your skin, and your brain just instantly fires off this message like, ah, solid matter, this thing is real.
Right, yeah. It feels so undeniably obvious that the desk exists entirely on its own, just, sitting there in space, waiting for you to interact with it.
Exactly. But today we are actually turning that exact assumption completely inside out. We are doing a deep dive into a perspective where the very fact that you can see or touch or, I don't know, interact with the world around you, like that desk, your phone, the floor beneath your feet, is actually the ultimate proof that absolutely none of it exists as a solid, independent substance.
Yeah, it is a profoundly mind-bending paradox. And to unpack it, we're looking at a really fascinating compilation of non-substantialist philosophy. The sources for this deep dive pull from some of the most rigorous thinkers in history.
We're talking about figures like Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, Tsongkhapa, and Mipham Rinpoche.
Right. And the mission for this conversation is to guide you through this radically different perspective. We want to show you why the classic debate between materialism and idealism actually kind of misses the entire point of what reality is.
Yeah, and more importantly, how shifting your view from a universe made of solid things to a reality of, well, empty luminous patterns might completely change how you experience every single aspect of your life.
But to get to that beautiful, luminous perspective, we first have to do a bit of a philosophical demolition job. I mean, we really have to tear down our most comfortable, basic assumption about the universe.
Right, the idea that stuff has its own independent essence.
Exactly. Whether you believe the universe is made of physical matter or if you're on the other side and think it's all made of consciousness, we assume there is a core essence. In the texts, this is called intrinsic nature.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because usually, when people argue about what reality is ultimately made of, they aggressively defend one of two camps.
Yeah, it's very polarized.
Right, so you have the materialists who say, at the end of the day, everything boils down to physical matter, like atoms and quarks. And then you have the idealists who say, no, matter is an illusion. Everything ultimately boils down to mind or universal consciousness.
And what is so fascinating here is that the non-substantialist view just cuts right through both of those camps with a single stroke.
It just completely bypasses the debate.
It really does. The text points out that it actually doesn't matter if you say ultimate reality is matter or if you say it's mind, because both of those worldviews share a hidden, fatal assumption.
And that assumption is that there is some self-existing thing holding everything up, right?
Yes, they both assume there's a foundational thing that stands entirely on its own and then, goes on to explain the appearances of the world. But the brilliant insight from these sources is that if that foundational thing can appear to us, or if it can interact with anything else whatsoever, it instantly fails the test of being a self-sufficient substance.
Wait, my brain is kind of halting on that. Why does interacting with something disqualify it from being independent? I mean, if I am an independent person, I can still shake your hand.
Well, let's look at the mechanics of what independence actually means in this context. If an entity truly had intrinsic nature, like a completely independent essence, it would have to remain entirely self-contained.
Meaning it couldn't change at all.
Exactly. It couldn't be altered, it couldn't be revealed, and it couldn't be conditioned by anything outside of itself. The exact moment interaction happens, that entity is suddenly open. It's conditioned. It becomes co-defined by what it is not.
I think I need to ground this in something physical. I am really struggling to see how interaction destroys independence.
Sure, let's use a physical example.
Let's use the desk or maybe a brick wall. If I press my bare hand against a rough brick wall, I feel hardness. My brain says the wall has the essence of being hard. How does my hand touching the wall destroy its independent nature?
Okay, so let's walk through the physics of that exact interaction. The sources actually present four different ways things interact, and all four completely destroy the idea of a solid, independent brick wall.
Okay, lay them on me.
First, let's look at being affected. When you press your hand against the wall, the heat from your hand slightly warms the surface of the brick.
Right.
So the brick state now depends on your hand. Its complete independence is just gone.
Okay, so because the wall absorbs my body heat, its current state is partially made of my hand's heat. It's not a lone wolf anymore.
Exactly. Moving to the second way, which is affecting something else, your hand feels pain from the rough brick, right? The wall is causing an effect in you.
Yes, yeah, scraping my skin.
That means the wall's identity now includes a causal role toward your hand. That causal role only exists because your hand is actually there to be scraped. So the wall's nature is suddenly relational.
Oh, wow. That one is a bit trippy. The wall can't be a scraper unless there's a hand there to scrape. So the hand is basically required for the wall to do its thing.
You're getting it. Now the third way is being revealed. You only know the wall is hard because your soft hand provided the resistance to reveal it. The hardness requires the condition of a meeting point.
Okay, and what's the fourth?
The fourth is being distinguished. You only identify the wall as a wall by contrasting it with what is not the wall, like the surrounding air, the ground, or your hand.
Right. Without that boundary created by everything else in the universe, the wall just kind of blends into everything. It can't be identified.
Exactly. In every single scenario, the very moment your hand meets the brick, the independence vanishes.
So we always assume the brick wall is just sitting there in the dark, possessing this secret hidden trait called hardness, just waiting around for someone to touch it. But you're saying the hardness doesn't actually belong to the wall.
No, it doesn't.
The hardness only exists in the meeting of the hand and the brick.
Yes. You are touching on the profound inversion of this entire philosophy. We usually think solid things exist first, and then they interact. The non-substantialist view flips that entirely. Interaction itself, relationality, is what appears as things.
Wait, to function is to be empty.
Yes. To interact is to be entirely empty of a core essence.
But hold on, if we accept this, like if my baseball isn't a solid pre-existing thing and a glass window isn't a solid thing, how on earth does a baseball shatter a window?
That's the natural next question, yeah.
Because if there is no solid stuff pushing other solid stuff around, how did the glass break? Something had to cause it. This feels like it completely breaks the laws of physics.
And that exact dilemma is what drove the philosopher Nagarjuna to completely tear down our everyday understanding of cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
He takes an incredibly uncompromising stance on this.
That's so.
He argues that if a baseball truly had an intrinsic independent nature, it could never be produced, and it could actually never produce an effect.
Why not? I mean, if it's a solid baseball, it should be great at breaking things.
Because if something is completely independent, it doesn't need a cause, and it cannot be forced to change. A truly independent baseball would be frozen in his baseballness forever.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it couldn't fly through the air, couldn't bend a window pane, and it couldn't bounce. Nagarjuna analyzes how anything could possibly happen in a universe of solid substances and finds it impossible. He breaks it down into four failures.
Okay, walk me through the failures. Let's use a seed growing into a tree.
Perfect example. First, can the tree arise from itself? No, that's redundant. If it produces itself, it already exists, so no new growth actually happens.
Makes sense.
Second, can it arise from something completely different, say a rock? That's incoherent. If a rock is completely different from a tree, how does it suddenly produce a tree? There has to be a continuous link.
Right, you don't plant gravel and get an oak tree.
Exactly. The third failure is saying it arises from both itself and another. But that just combines the logical impossibilities of the first two.
And the fourth.
Does the tree arise from neither? If it comes from absolutely nothing, well, that's pure randomness. Oak trees would just pop out of the sky. The universe would be chaotic magic.
So Nagarjuna concludes that as long as we believe in solid, independent substances, nothing can ever be produced.
Right.
So what does this all mean, practically? If nothing is actually produced, isn't that just a fancy, philosophical way of saying causality is a complete lie?
Not quite, no.
Let me use another example. I am out in the woods, I'm freezing cold, and I light a campfire. I hold my hands out. If the fire isn't a solid substance, and it doesn't produce heat to give to me, what is warming my hands?
Yeah.
I mean, I am definitely not freezing anymore.
This requires a really vital reframe. Causality is absolutely not a lie. We rely on it constantly. The problem is just that we misunderstand how it functions.
Okay, how does it function then?
Causality is not the transmission of a physical substance from one solid thing to another. There is no hidden heat substance inside the burning wood that gets pushed out, travels through the air, and gets injected into your hands.
So there are no microscopic heat particles jumping ship from the logs to my fingers.
None at all. Instead, the sources describe causality as stable relational patterning. Think about what makes the campfire. You have wood, oxygen, a spark of friction, and your spatial proximity to it.
Right, all those conditions.
Exactly. When that specific, complex web of relations aligns, the pattern we call warmth reliably appears. Nothing is being pushed. No substance is transferring. The overall relational pattern of the universe in that localized spot is simply shifting.
Okay, I am following the logic here, but I can feel a very natural fear creeping in right now for myself and probably for you listening.
Yeah, that happens a lot with this topic.
Because if we were saying there are no underlying entities, no solid physical matter, no inherent consciousness, and that all of causality, everything we do and feel is just, you know, patterns, aren't we sliding straight into a deeply depressing nihilism?
It can definitely feel that way at first.
Like, if nothing has an essence, isn't the ultimate takeaway just that nothing is real, everything is an illusion, and frankly, nothing actually matters?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that fear is the single most common and really the most dangerous misunderstanding of emptiness. Saying something is empty of inherent nature does not mean nothing exists.
It doesn't.
No, it does not mean your life is a meaningless void. In fact, the texts argue the exact opposite. Things can function and life can happen precisely because things are not fixed.
Wait, emptiness is the only reason I can warm my hands.
Yes. If the universe were made of permanent, unchangeable, independent substances, absolutely nothing could ever move or grow or change or interact. The universe would literally be a frozen, dead museum.
Wow.
Emptiness is just the openness that allows dynamic life to occur. The sources use a very vivid analogy to pull us out of this nihilism trap. They use the analogy of a rainbow.
Okay, paint that picture for me.
When you look up at a rainbow after a storm, you know rationally that you cannot walk up to it with a bucket and scoop out a core essence of rainbow stuff.
Right, it doesn't have a solid body.
Exactly. It is entirely empty of a findable substance. Yet it is undeniably vivid. It arches across the sky. It is a highly organized spectrum of colors. It follows the strict laws of optics. And it is a real experience. It's an empty patterning.
I love that. It's empty, but it still puts on a spectacular show. It still stops you in your tracks.
That hits the nail on the head. And this integrates beautifully with a concept in Dzogchen called luminous display.
Luminous display.
Yeah. Reality is empty, meaning it has no hidden essence.
Mm-hmm.
But it is patterned, meaning it's structured by relationships, not just pure chaos. It is regular, which is why causality works and why you can trust the campfire to warm you. And finally, it is luminous, meaning it is vividly, brightly, immediately experienced by you.
Okay, let me test a metaphor on you to see if I'm fully grasping this luminous display idea.
Go for it.
If I'm hearing this right, we should really stop picturing reality as a bunch of solid billiard balls violently crashing into each other on a pool table. Is it more like watching a giant wave move rapidly across the ocean?
How do you mean?
Like, the actual water molecules themselves aren't migrating miles across the sea, right? They just bob up and down. What's actually rushing toward the shore is just a pattern of energy traveling through the relations of the water. Is that a better way to look at it?
That ocean wave metaphor is extremely tempting. And honestly, it's a great stepping stone. But the sources actually warn us against stopping there. There's a massive trap in that analogy.
Oh, where did I go wrong?
Well, even the ocean analogy assumes there is a base substance, the water, that is sitting there holding the pattern. It implies there is an underlying stuff that the energy travels through.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the radical non-substantialist view pushes for a much sharper inversion. There is no water. There are no things that have patterns. There are only patterns appearing as things.
My mind is officially blown. There is no water, only patterns appearing as things. But, you know, while this sounds incredibly beautiful to talk about in a studio, this vivid, luminous, empty display, trying to actually maintain this exact mental balance seems nearly impossible.
It is incredibly difficult, yes.
I mean, accepting that reality is completely empty of substance, but simultaneously vividly real and functioning. I have to imagine that balancing act has caused some massive historical fights among the greatest minds in this tradition.
Oh, definitely.
How do we keep this worldview from tipping too far into depressing nihilism on one side, or accidentally sneaking a comforting substance back in on the other?
This raises such an important question, and it takes us straight into the heart of a legendary philosophical debate between two absolute giants in this field, Tsongkhapa and Mipham Rinpoche.
Okay, let's hear about the debate.
To understand their fight, we first have to recognize their shared ground. Neither of them is a nihilist. They both completely agree on the rules of the game. There's no intrinsic nature, and dependent arising, the way empty patterns function, is valid.
Okay, so they both agree the universe isn't made of billiard balls. What are they actually fighting about?
The clash is entirely about how to explain the appearance of the world without accidentally turning that appearance back into a sneaky, hidden substance. Let's look at Tsongkhapa first.
What was his stance?
His primary overwhelming goal is to protect the concept of emptiness. He's terrified of people clinging to illusions. So he focuses heavily on a mechanism called dependent designation.
Let me guess. This means things only exist because we know them?
Essentially, yes. It means things exist conventionally only through conceptual imputation. The mind looks at a collection of parts and designates a whole.
Right.
Think about a car. If you take a wrench and start dismantling a car looking for its core essence, where is it? Is the carness inside the spark plugs? No. Is it in the steering wheel? No. Is in the rubber tires? No.
Right. If you lay all those parts out on a garage floor, you just have a pile of metal and rubber. The car only exists because my mind desperately wants to draw a circle around the pile and slap the label car on it.
Precisely the point Tsong Khapa makes. He, along with another brilliant thinker named Chandrakirti, has a surgical concern. He says, do not let the vivid appearances of the world seduce your mind into believing there is something solidly findable hiding under analysis.
But there's a risk there, right?
The severe risk, yes.
I can feel it. If you emphasize that absolutely everything is just a conceptual designation, reality starts to sound very thin. It feels lightweight, almost like the universe is merely a mental illusion, or just a dry, mechanical spreadsheet of conventions. It risks taking all the magic and the visceral reality out of the room.
Mipham Rinpoche thought the exact same thing. He pushes back hard against that thinness. Mipham argues that we shouldn't let the rigor of emptiness become a weapon that destroys the vividness of life.
That makes a lot of sense.
For Mipham, appearances are not merely cheap conceptual labels slapped onto reality by a paranoid mind. Appearances are vivid, luminous, and valid in their own right. They're naturally self-presenting. He really emphasizes the radiant clarity of experience.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Because I hear Mipham talking about how reality is naturally vivid and luminous in its own right, and a giant red flag just goes up in my mind.
What's the flag?
If we say appearance is inherently luminous, don't we risk sneaking substance right back through the back door? Like, we threw out physical matter, we threw out universal mind, but now we're pretending luminosity or clarity is some magical hidden soul that everything possesses.
You've zeroed in on the exact fault line of the entire debate.
Mm-hmm.
That is the massive trap Mipham flirts with.
I knew it!
Tsong Khapa protects emptiness flawlessly, but he risks deflating the vibrant reality of appearance. Mipham protects the vibrancy beautifully, but he risks reifying it, turning luminosity into a subtle substance, a secret mode of being that things secretly possess.
It feels like an impossible standoff. I mean, if both of these geniuses are risking falling off the tightrope, how do we resolve this? How do we hold on to the incredibly vivid, rich reality that Mipham wants without losing the rigorous, logically flawless emptiness that Tsong Khapa demands?
The sources offer a really profound synthesis to bridge this exact gap, and it relies on fundamentally redefining two words, designation and luminosity.
Okay, how so?
First, we refine Tsong Khapa's idea. Designation is not just a mental label imposed by an observing human brain. And second, we refine Mipham's idea. Luminosity is not a standalone essence or a glowing property that belongs to an object.
Okay, so what is it then?
The synthesis reveals that appearance is designated natively through relational difference.
Designation through relational difference. That sounds a bit dense. How does a difference designate reality?
Let's illustrate this with a massive thought experiment. I want you to imagine a universe that is uniformly, entirely blue. Every molecule, every inch of space, every single thing is the exact same shade of blue.
Okay, I am picturing a giant blue void.
In that world, the concept of blue cannot even be recognized. It doesn't appear as a distinct phenomenon. You could stare at it for a trillion years and never see blue.
Because there's nothing to compare it to.
Exactly. But the exact millisecond you introduce the color yellow into that universe, what happens? Suddenly, fiercely, blue appears.
Wait, let me stop and push on this. Are you saying that the contrast itself creates the reality? Because my instinct goes right back to Tsong Khapa. Does this mean a human mind has to be standing there in the universe to conceptually label the blue and the yellow for them to exist?
The text provides a crucial clarification here, and the answer is absolutely not. This is not just conceptual labeling by an observing mind. It is designation by relation.
Designation by relation.
Right. The structural relationship itself is what appears. The boundary, the contrast between blue and yellow, is the only thing that allows either of them to manifest at all. It's not that a human mind forces a label onto them. It's that phenomena natively arise entirely through their contrast with what they are not.
So the contrast isn't something we add later. The contrast is baked into the very fabric of the appearance itself.
To take that a step further, the contrast is the appearance. And this brilliantly resolves the tension between the two philosophers. Because phenomena only appear through relational contrast, They can never be isolated or found as standalone substances.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, if you look for the essence of blue, you just find its relationship to yellow. That satisfies Tsongkhapa. The unfindability of an appearance is exactly what its emptiness is.
And what about Mifum's luminosity? How does that fit in?
Because this relational contrast natively produces immediate, vivid experience. Just like the sudden burst of blue and yellow, we don't need to invent a hidden soul of clarity to explain why things feel so intensely real. That satisfies Mifum.
Wow, that just perfectly bridges the gap.
Emptiness doesn't weaken appearance into a mere thought, and luminosity doesn't elevate appearance into a permanent substance. Empty relationality itself is what appears so vividly.
That is just staggering. It really shifts everything. It's like realizing the universe isn't a massive collection of nouns bumping into each other. It's an endless, shimmering web of verbs.
That is a brilliant way to put it.
Okay, let's bring this all together. We have covered some immense philosophical ground today. We started by dismantling the incredibly comforting idea of solid substances, whether that's physical matter or an independent consciousness. We realized that the very fact we can touch a brick wall proves it depends on us and therefore lacks a standalone essence.
We then explored how that completely redefines cause and effect. We saw that causality isn't the transfer of microscopic stuff from a fire into your hands. It's simply reliable, stable patterning within a complex web of relations.
And finally, we navigated the great historical debates to discover that reality isn't a thin, depressing mental illusion, nor is it a heavy fixed substance. It is a luminous, empty display, a vibrant reality that functions entirely through contrast and relationship, like blue relying entirely on yellow.
And if we connect this incredible philosophy back to why it actually matters to you, the listener, in your everyday life, think about the times you feel completely stuck.
Yeah, we all have those moments.
Think about when you are overwhelmed by rigid problems at work, or when you feel trapped by fixed labels about yourself, or when a relationship feels impossibly broken. We tend to view our problems as solid substances. We treat our anxiety or our conflicts as immovable brick walls.
We really do.
But remember the core lesson here. Absolutely nothing has intrinsic nature. Your conflicts, your stresses, your very identity, they are all relational patterns. Because they are empty, they're guaranteed not to be permanent. And because they are relational, by simply shifting the conditions around them, the entire pattern can and inevitably will change.
Your problems aren't solid bricks. They are just a temporary rainbow you happen to be standing inside of right now. I love that.
It's a very freeing perspective.
It really is. And to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over long after this deep dive ends, if every single thing you interact with, every desk you touch, every conflict you face, every color you see is a temporary luminous pattern rather than a fixed substance, well, what about the you that is listening to my voice right now?
That is the ultimate question.
The next time you confidently knock your knuckles against a wooden desk, ask yourself, are you really a standalone, independent entity observing a universe from the outside? Or are you, too, just a vivid, empty pattern appearing entirely through your brilliant, ongoing collision with the rest of the world?